is working on the runway to get the...
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you, Susan, for being with us. Your phone line is breaking up as you're on the U.S. air base at Buchel in Western Germany. Susan Crane, one of the anti-nuclear activists arrested at Buchel Air Force Base in the Netherlands, just arrived at the Buchel Air Force Base for today's action. And John LaForge, co-director of Nuke Watch, now back home in Luck, Wisconsin. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KBOO's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kboo.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, dozens of lives, hundreds of homes lost to wildfires in Hawaii. The fires also burn in Oregon, with hundreds of people and homes at risk.
You will start seeing some small increase in activity and smoke during the day or in the evening.
And a mental health crisis affecting Gen Z.
After the pandemic, it sort of normalized it. Like, hey, everyone can have a mental health condition. People started to see that youth also have these same issues.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 10th, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us tonight. Deadly wildfires ravaged an unusual location, the state of Hawaii. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
One of the deadliest U.S. wildfires seen in years has struck the state of Hawaii. Thousands of residents raced to escape their homes on the island of Maui as the flames destroyed much of a centuries-old town and killed at least 36 people. Crews battled blazes in several places on the island yesterday, and the flames forced some adults and children to flee into the ocean. The fire took Maui by surprise, destroying cars, boats, trees, and historic buildings in Lahaina Town, which dates to the 1700s. Lahaina Town has long been a favorite tourist destination. Though it's not clear how they started, a dangerous mix of conditions appears to have made the fires particularly damaging, including high winds, low humidity, and dry vegetation. The fires were also whipped by strong winds from Hurricane Dora, passing far to the south. This is another example of a disaster caused by extreme weather this summer, with experts saying climate change is increasing the likelihood of such events. Fires in Hawaii are unlike many of those burning in the U.S. Northwest. They tend to break out in large grasslands on the dry sides of the islands and are generally much smaller than mainland fires. A major fire on the Big Island in 2021 did burn homes and force thousands to evacuate. The Big Island is currently seeing fires, although there have been no reports of injuries or destroyed homes there. About 14,500 customers in Maui were without power yesterday. Officials were working to get communications restored, to distribute water, and possibly to add law enforcement personnel. National Guard helicopters had dropped 150,000 gallons of water on the Maui fires. The Coast Guard rescued at least 14 people who had jumped into the ocean to escape flames and smoke, including two children. Tourists have been advised to stay away, and about 11,000 visitors flew out of Maui yesterday. Officials prepared the Hawaii Convention Center in Honolulu to take in thousands who have been displaced. President Biden ordered all available federal assets to help with a response. Officials warn that the death toll in Hawaii could still rise, with the fire still burning and teams spreading out to search burned areas. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Meantime, the bedrock fire in central Oregon has spread to more than 15,000 acres. Last night, hundreds of people logged on to a community meeting about the efforts to fight the fire.
I'm Jeff Demke, the incident commander for Northwest Team 12. And so, you know, we talked about the weather, the fire, the activities here, and I'm going to try to answer a couple of questions that were handed to me, but also go over some of the actions that were going were taking place. So, like on Bedrock, we're going to see some increased smoke and activity up here because it's going to take us some time to get around this fire, and we're doing very small firing operations to start burning out our containment lines with a whole bunch of resources, and we have staffing for those resources. We're actually running three different shifts right now. We have a day shift, a night shift, and a swing shift, and they're adjusting to our schedule and our operations to meet the needs. And so you will start seeing some small increase in activity and smoke during the day or in the evening when we have those opportunities to burn those chunks of line to secure them on our schedule. And so when we have the right environment and we can contain the fire, we're going to slowly and with effort go ahead and start. We have already been doing this where we've liked to stick on places where it's easy to catch fire, which is river, ridges, and roads. And also we're going direct to minimize some of the smoke. So we're taking multiple actions trying to suppressing this fire. The actions we're taking are based off the terrain and the hazards and the mitigations that we have in place and trying to reduce risk to firefighters and also you as the public. Our number one priority is firefighter and public safety. We're here on behalf of the agencies and also you as the public. We're here, we're suppressing this fire, and we're trying to put it out as quickly and as small as possible. And sometimes that small as possible includes these burnout and these other options. The opposite's going on over here. We showed up. We were not assigned this fire. It started literally the day we were assuming command, and we took this fire in conjunction with the agencies and sent resources. Even though it wasn't ours, we sent stuff to help out. Recognize that a new start is the highest priority and we need to catch it while it's small. In the end, we ended up assuming command of this because it made sense. We were already here. We had resources. We sent stuff to help. And we went direct, recognizing the values at risk and where we are here and where we are at, located to the community of Oak Ridge and High Prairie. That direct attack was successful. We recognize there is risk, but we also recognize the values there. And so a lot of effort and a lot of people put themselves at risk to do this. And we've been very successful. We're at about a little over 100 acres on that fire. The containment date was brought up on this in the log. In this fuel type in the west side of Oregon, things don't just go out. It takes a whole lot of horsepower and a whole lot of heartbeats to go out there and put these to bed. So you probably will see people out here for about the next month checking this, mopping it up. We will have a large presence here our entire duration here, which is the next 2 weeks. So there's going to be traffic. There's going to be people out here on this fire. We still have aviation. It is going to take a while to put that out or call it contained. Also, you heard operations talk about we have line around this. The reason we're still showing 0% is we don't like to show high percentage containment. We don't know we have it. We like to make sure if we're going to put 5, 10, 50%, that's not going to change. So you're going to see us slowly increase these numbers, even though we have line all the way around this. You're not going to see us move this to 100% here in the next couple days. It's going to slowly climb up. The rationale behind that is there's still fire in here. There's still rollout. There's still activity. It's not just going to go stop smoking and be out. This thing could smoke for weeks and months on end at the smaller scale. And we can only work in this area after we've mitigated hazards, and that's going to take time to do. Over here on Bedrock, remember which fire I'm talking about now, the previous team left us with an outstanding package. They had done some great planning and coordination and communication with the public and the agencies. A direct approach was used here. We're continuing with direct here, and we figured out a couple spots to go direct and try to decrease smoke and exposure to firefighters, but we can't do that on the whole fire. And so that's why we're moving into that indirect action in those firing operations, because that's the best place to be where we have the highest probability of success with the lowest impact to fire or lowest risk to firefighters without getting anybody hurt or killed. And that's our main focus, right? We want to keep this fire small. We want to get back to we have lives, we have homes, we want to get back to those. But for us to be successful, we have to take those actions. And that's how we mitigate hazards and we make fires as small as possible. I think I answered the closure question. There's one is about, will we lift the closure on this when the fire is contained? Yes, it actually might be lifted before the fire is actually fully contained and activity in that area is decreased. I answered the one about the containment date. It just takes a really long time to put these fires out. Sometimes it's Mother Nature in winter, and you'll still see smokes the next year. For example, cedar popped a smoke in it, which was a holdover from out in the middle of the black from last year. That's been a year, right? So Mother Nature has a play in this, and it also helps us be successful.
Jason Prentice, Air Resource Advisor, assigned here to the Bedrock Fire. My role here with the fire is to, well, one of them is to make sure that the public has information related to smoke from the fire and how it'll impact your air quality on a day-to-day basis. One of the best links we have to share with you is fire.airnow.gov. You can go to this site. It will show you all the air quality sensors that are around, both that the state puts out, that we at the fire put out, as well as some sensors that you guys as citizens have out there at your homes and businesses. This site will provide you with things like a graph of air quality over the past week and give you tips on actions that you can take depending upon if the air quality is moderate, unhealthy for sensitive groups, or even unhealthy for everyone out there. Daily here at the fire, we're producing smoke outlooks. They're provided not only on that fire.airnow.gov, but also provided by the Public Information Office here at the fire. They will have expected air quality index values for today and tomorrow, as well as a lookout further into the future. We are taking into account both the Bedrock and the Salmon fires, as well as considering Lookout and Wiley fires that are further to the north and their impacts that they could have on this area in regards to smoke. Thankfully, we've been in a pattern with the weather conditions. We have primarily seen good to moderate air quality conditions overall. However, we do see brief moments where we reach unhealthy for sensitive groups or unhealthy for all. When we do see those, and you can, you know, see and smell those impacts, we encourage you to take steps to keep yourself safe, whether that's going indoors, finding a spot that does have good air quality, and then there. And we do have a list of actions to protect yourself here included in the outlook. Don't expect much change with the incoming weather. We are considering operations and when they are putting additional smoke into the air. So we do expect primarily good to moderate conditions for most, but we may see maybe a slight increase in those periods of unhealthy for sensitive groups and unhealthy overall. Have any additional questions, we can be sure to answer before this meeting's over. Thanks.
An emergency closure order is in effect for the Willamette National Forest for the Bedrock Fire, which has spread to more than 15,000 acres, and the Salmon Fire, burning on 135 acres. In Linn County, new Level 1 and Level 2 evacuation orders are in effect after the sheriff called them in response to the Wiley Fire, which has spread to 165 acres. A new report shows 1 in 4 of those who are part of Gen Z say they're feeling emotionally distressed. Eric Tegedoff talked to mental health care advocates here in the Pacific Northwest.
Mental health is a major issue for young people of Generation Z, people who were born after 1996, and research finds they report feeling emotionally distressed at more than 3 times the rate of baby boomers. Deidre Burke is a youth and young adult program manager at NAMI Washington. She says stigma around mental health issues is the biggest barrier to getting help, although conversations about it are becoming more prevalent.
Now, after the pandemic, it sort of normalized it. Like, hey, everyone can have a mental health condition. People started to see that youth also have these same issues. They have symptoms. They're having mental health conditions.
While there is less of a stigma now, Burke says there's still much more work to do. She says people should first speak to a trusted person in their life if they start to suspect mental health concerns. National Medical Director for Behavioral Health with United Healthcare, Dr. Donald Tavakoli, says as Gen Zers enter the workforce and become eligible for their own healthcare plans, it's important they understand the mental health coverage benefits they have. He's found many young people value virtual visits.
So increasingly, health plans offer telehealth that can be in-network opportunities to support your mental health. And it's important to find a health plan that offers those.
Even as the pandemic subsides, NAMI's Burke says its effects won't go away because it was such a traumatic event.
Trauma lasts a lifetime. And a lot of these youth, this is like their fundamental development year. So this will last them their entire life.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Experts say more people are heading to states like Nevada for birth control access. Alex Gonzalez reports.
Democratic Nevada Senator Catherine Cortez Masto recently met with reproductive rights advocates to discuss the need to ensure all Nevada women have access to birth control without a prescription. In July, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the first birth control pill, which is set to be made available over-the-counter in early 2024. The price for the drug has yet to be released. Cortes Masto emphasized the need for her reintroduced Affordability is Access Act, which would ensure women have affordable access to over-the-counter birth control without a prescription.
And this is the legislation I've introduced, is to make it sure it is affordable. So to ensure that our insurance companies keep the costs low, just like on the Affordable Care Act marketplace, we want to ensure that women can access contraception over-the-counter and it's affordable for them.
Cortes Masto says the biggest barrier for many is cost. She adds she's proud that Nevada has remained a pro-choice state and realizes many women are coming to Nevada in search of reproductive health care services, as some conservatives at the state and federal level aim to restrict or outlaw access to contraceptive care. Executive Director for Planned Parenthood Votes Nevada, Lindsay Harmon, says they've seen an increase in the number of people frequenting Planned Parenthood health centers in the Silver State. As she says, they're scared or confused about the laws in their respective home states. Harmon says after the Dobbs decision, which ended the constitutional right to abortion, some lawmakers are now targeting contraceptive access, to which she says they're fighting back.
We are looking to cover a full spectrum of health care because we know that in this country, elected officials, particularly those who are anti-women and anti-choice and anti-trans, are coming and targeting, you know, every part of a person's reproductive health care.
Advocates say for many across Nevada and the country, contraception isn't about family planning, but rather a health care issue. In June, Governor Joe Lombardo vetoed Assembly Bill 383, which would have protected the right to contraceptives for all Nevadans. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth, featuring the Global Citizen International Digest with Mel Gertoff and a story on extreme heat events and climate change. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, clear skies down to 60. Tomorrow's weather sunny, a high of 85. Today in history, on this date in 2003, temperatures in the United Kingdom topped 100 degrees Fahrenheit for the first time during a European heat wave. Our quote of the day is from Toni Morrison. I have only to break into the tightness of a strawberry and I see summer, its dust and lowering skies. New York creates a statewide cybersecurity plan. Ghost gun legislation is reintroduced. Election workers gear up for the 2024 elections. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here is today's edition of 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Cyber criminals are determined to disrupt our systems and our lives. Their intent is nothing but malicious, statement of fact, and they're only getting more brazen.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul has announced a statewide cybersecurity protection strategy. This comes after the White House held its first cybersecurity summit aimed at addressing ransomware attacks on U.S. public schools. According to FBI data, more than 25,000 New Yorkers were victims of cyber attacks in the last year. The new strategy will provide increased cybersecurity services to county and local governments and allocate funds to expand the state's cybersecurity workforce. U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal has reintroduced the Ghost Guns and Untraceable Firearms Act. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives reported the number of recovered and traced ghost guns increased by more than 1,000% between 2016 and 2021, and many have been tied to unsolved crimes across the country. By including unfinished frames and receivers in the federal definition of a firearm, people would have to undergo background checks before purchasing these kits. During a 2021 hearing, Blumenthal said the guns are created with the intent of bypassing federal regulations.
They will make a mockery of all other common sense gun safety steps. They will render meaningless background checks and other common sense regulation that now apply to make America safer.
While the 2024 election is still more than a year away, New Mexico election workers are still facing fallout from the last presidential election. A Brennan Center survey found 45% of respondents are concerned about their safety amid increased threats from voters questioning the validity of elections. David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation and Research says it has become an ongoing part of being an election worker.
They are still dealing with this stuff. They are still suffering. They are still being harassed. They are still being attacked. That's the state we're in now, in early August, 15 months before a presidential election.
New Mexico was one of several states where the former president is accused of trying to persuade state officials to swing the election his way. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Montana is drafting a new wolf management plan expected to be released for public comment at the end of this month. However, people who love wolves and don't hunt say they want a say in how the animals are counted. Mark Moran has the story.
The Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department is coming up with a new wolf management plan, but there's disagreement over how the animals are being counted. Critics contend the state is not taking the non-hunting public into account. Montana Fish and Wildlife says hunters and trappers took 248 wolves in the state last year, far below the allowed quota of 450. A higher number of wolves in Montana, combined with extending the hunting season to 6 months, has drawn criticism from people who love wolves but who don't hunt them. Mark Cook, with the group Wolves of the Rockies, says the state's keeping so-called non-consumptive wolf supporters out of the counting process, playing to big game hunting interests instead.
And by doing this, what it's doing is it's commercializing our wildlife.
Cook adds that wolf watchers have a better understanding than hunters of how many wolves there really are. The state estimates the value of tourists coming to Montana to see wolves at $82 million a year. A draft wolf management plan is expected to be released for public comment by the end of August. Fish and Wildlife relies on hunter surveys, estimates, pack size, and territory to arrive at a wolf count, and Cook says non-consumptive Montanans, such as Wolves of the Rockies, have been kept out of the process.
We've applied to virtually every group that the department has set up to seek guidance from the Montana community, and the department continually refuses to select us to be part of that process. They don't want us involved because the fact is, we know what we're talking about.
Wolves were taken off the endangered species list in Montana and other areas of the Northern Rockies in 2011, but remain protected elsewhere in the lower 48. I'm Mark Moran.
A Pueblo governor issues a call to action after a fire in New Mexico. With that story and more, here's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. Governor Max A. Zuni of Isleta Pueblo in New Mexico has issued a call for action after the recent fire near the tribal community this last weekend. In a letter sent out to more than 16 surrounding communities, he said, quote, "When the area was first planned, it was built for housing, retail, and office space. Now, however, it houses industrial facilities, which impacts all of our neighbors, including the Pueblo of Isleta," end quote. The tribal community is located near Albuquerque. Zuni says the Albuquerque-Bernalillo County Air Quality Program and the Isleta Fire Department issued health advisories Sunday, warning residents to remain indoors through Monday morning to avoid the hazardous pollution. Zuni said the fire threatened the community's health during a heat wave, leaving residents to decide whether to use their evaporative air conditioners and expose their homes to hazardous pollutants or to suffer through the extreme temperatures. The Pueblo is calling on local governments to take action and collaborate with the Pueblo. The Pueblo is concerned about health impacts to people and the environment. The Alaska Federation of Natives is fishing for photos to share at its convention this October, and it's offering prizes for those which best reflect this year's theme, Our Ways of Life. The contest opened at the beginning of the month, and Ben Malott, AFN's Vice President of External Affairs, says there's already been quite a catch. Malott says the contest will help to generate interest in the convention, but also has another important purpose.
We plan to use the photos that we get throughout our convention materials, look at our app, look at our convention guide. Hopefully we can use photos that show our ways of life throughout all of our materials.
Malott says the more photos, the better, so they can be used after the convention to help AFN continue to advocate for Native causes.
AFN works in so many different arenas and so many different policy areas. that sometimes having the right picture really brings it home.
AFN wants photographs that capture Alaska landscapes, hunting, fishing, families, elders, youth, regalia, and other daily activities or special events. So far, many of the photos capture children and elders taking part in subsistence activities. Malott says one of his personal favorites is a snapshot of a little boy posing alongside a freshly caught fish, making a fish face. The first prize is two round-trip Alaska airline tickets with $500 in cash for second place and $250 for third. The Alaska Travel Industry Association has created a new seat on its board set aside for tribal representation. The head of the association, Jillian Simpson, said it's not only the right thing to do, but good for business.
I think people want to have an authentic experience when they travel someplace, and Alaska is the only place in the world that has the living cultures of Alaska Native people.
Camille Ferguson, a Tlingit from Sitka, currently holds one of the ATIA's 24 board seats. She says it's important that tourism marketing is culturally authentic, and a tribal representative would have the most expertise in that area.
Authenticity from imagery, content, and video is so important to have somebody who is at that table to help them.
Ferguson worked for the American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association based in New Mexico, where she saw how tribal representation helped the travel industry develop culturally sensitive practices. She says not all states collaborate with tribes, but should, not just for diversity's sake, but to improve the overall tourism experience. She says until recently, the cruise industry defined the portrayal of Southeast Alaska, limiting its focus to Alaska Natives to only Ketchikan, Russian history in Sitka, and glaciers in Juneau. Ferguson says Alaska's travel industry is finally coming around to recognizing the untapped potential of cultural tourism. The tribal seat on the ATIA board is open to members of a federally recognized tribe or an Alaska Native Corporation shareholder and should bring more involvement from tribal travel and tourism leaders. Board elections are in September. I'm Jill Freitas.
A Native community in Washington State is getting better broadband. A rural community restores limited emergency health services, and the Oppenheimer movie has renewed talk about nuclear testing. Here are the stories making headlines in rural communities.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. A small community in Tennessee has scored a health victory, in spite of medical care becoming a challenge for rural folks. 4 years ago, Jamestown, Tennessee's hospital closed, leaving residents without any nearby critical care. Now, the University of Tennessee Medical Center has opened a new emergency room clinic to reduce travel time and help close the gap.
People have had to drive half hour, 45 minutes to a larger population area for emergency care.
Daily Yonder contributor Keith Royston says while the new ER clinic will benefit Jamestown residents, it won't replace the services, jobs, and population that happens when hospitals close, which Royston says is becoming more common across rural America.
Since 2005, nearly 200 rural hospitals have closed, so it's a problem in a number of locations.
In the remote Pacific Northwest, an Indian nation wants to close the digital divide for members and their rural neighbors. Susanna Brown has more.
A third of the Quinault Indian Nation has no internet access. Toptana Technologies, a first-of-its-kind indigenous-owned internet infrastructure company, plans to build out the first new subsea cable to reach Washington State in a generation. Tyson Johnston is the Quinault Nation's self-governance director.
Internet access is essential for our economies so we could have better access to healthcare resources, better access to educational resources.
The smart cable technology will also boost resiliency and safety in the face of climate change.
Having this infrastructure allows us to track if there was a change in the seafloor, seismic event, so we could be better prepared for emergencies.
I'm Susanna Brown.
Hollywood's Oppenheimer biopic is spotlighting New Mexico's role in World War II. J. Robert Oppenheimer led the Manhattan Project to develop the world's first atomic bomb. The movie recounts the 1945 Trinity test south of Los Alamos and has renewed efforts to expand healthcare coverage for people exposed to radiation from the nuclear blast.
There would have been no Manhattan Project or Trinity without the people of New Mexico, and our health was placed in danger because of that.
Tina Cordova with the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium applauds a preliminary vote in Congress to expand the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act to New Mexico beyond the original states of Arizona, Nevada, and Utah.
There was an admission of guilt on the part of the government when they established the Compensation Act, but it didn't go far enough.
Cordova says she's lost countless New Mexico relatives to cancer, many within a decade of the test. Summer may seem endless, or for school kids, fly by. Whichever, August is National Back to School Month. For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 10th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Tegedoff, Mark Moran, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth up next with the Global Citizen International Digest with Mil Gertov and a story on extreme heat events and climate change.